William the Conqueror and his successors retained and advanced this system. When William came in 1066, he had no reason to upset things. He does innovate in some respects. For example, in 1087, he carried out the massive Doomsday Survey, producing a remarkable document, a remarkable book, the most comprehensive accounting of the human and material resources of a kingdom until the U.S. Census of 1790. There was nothing like it again for a very long time. Well, quite simply, William had conquered England. He wanted to know, what's out there? What is it that I've got? What did I win? So he conducts this survey by sending investigators right round the country to ask questions and to count and to enumerate everything from mills to pigs and chickens to people. Henry I began the long evolution of the English exchequer. Henry I, William's son and successor from 1100 to 1135, the exchequer, so-called from the checkerboard cloth on which the accounts, the royal accounts, were reckoned. The chief financial branch of the English government is to this day called the exchequer, and its long history begins with Henry I, putting royal finances on a secure foundation. Henry also began sending out itinerant justices, justices who, in effect, extended the royal court throughout the realm. Now, one can ask, is this not in a way analogous to Charlemagne's Missi Dominici? And the answer is yes, of course it is. Was there a direct influence? That's possible. But the fact is that we now see measures like this being introduced in England. The royal court is extending itself throughout the realm. Royal law is extending throughout the realm. Now, as these royal courts gradually drew in sort of more and more and more serious business, and rendered judgments in more and more and more kinds of cases, the foundations were created in England for a common law, for a single law that would be applied throughout the country. By the time of King John of England, the English barons were increasingly distressed at the evolution of royal institutions over which they felt they had little control. That business that I mentioned that we would pursue not in great detail can be just mentioned here, namely the governing class. One of the things that Henry I, but then particularly Henry II, and also John had begun doing, was bringing middle-class men, urban men, and as we turn the corner to the 13th century, even men trained in universities, into their royal administration. Rather than holding all the, or reserving perhaps all of the key positions for members of the aristocracy, they began to draw in members of the middle classes who were likely to be much more loyal to the king because as the king had made them, he could unmake them. But I don't want to suggest that the English government had lost its aristocratic character by the year 1200, but it was perhaps changing ever so slightly. Well, anyway, the English barons were not very pleased at the direction the English government was taking, and they forced King John in the year 1215 to affix his signature to the Magna Carta, the Great Charter. Called the Great Charter not because it's great in the sense that it's wonderful, but great because it's big. It's a great big piece of parchment on which the charter was written out. The document insisted that the king was not above the law. Perhaps most fundamental, that's what it asserted. The king is not above the law. The king is answerable to the law, like everyone else. The barons also insisted that the king stop abusing what we call feudalism. Now, what they were objecting to was the king's exercise of some of his prerogatives, some of his rights as ruler, some of the things that he felt he could do because he was the king. Well, this brings us to the subject of feudalism, so let's put it on the table, mainly so we can take it back off the table. It used to be assumed that one could easily speak of medieval government in terms of a nice, tidy feudal pyramid. Now, about the only place you hear that any longer is, in maybe newspapers or in high school history books or places like that. One never finds serious scholars talking much about feudal pyramids, feudal systems, or even much about feudalism any longer. Now, the idea of a feudal pyramid, you know, was you had a society where the king was at the top and then he had his vassals and his vassals had vassals and those vassals had vassals and so on, sort of down arraying out pyramid style, and then presumably all the peasants were just squashed under the pyramid someplace. They didn't quite fit in this system. Now, it's perfectly true that there were lords and there were vassals in the Middle Ages. And it's perfectly true that vassals did swear homage and fealty. They swore, in other words, not to harm the interests of their lord. It's perfectly true as well that vassals agreed to provide auxilium et consilium, advice and counsel. Advice and aid, I'm sorry. Advice and aid.